Thank you for joining us on this episode of Eminent Teachnology with Dr. Rochelle Newton and Drew Stennett, where we examine current and emerging technologies through the lens of diversity and equality.
Absolutely.
All right. So hello, everybody. Welcome back to Eminent Teachnology with Dr. Rochelle Newton and Drew Stennett. Today, we have a guest that I am incredibly, incredibly excited about. I'm excited about all our guests, of course. But today, we are talking to Tom Banks, who is a theoretical physicist specializing in, I was reading your biography, Tom, and I made it through about a paragraph. And I was having to like tab out like every different word in there. And I was like, oh man, I'm so confused. And like, I feel like I knew a little bit about physics before going into all this. But could you tell us just a little bit about yourself and what you do?
So I'm a theoretical physicist. I work at Rutgers University in New Jersey. I've been doing this for a long, long time. I got my PhD in 1973.
Nice.
And I worked after that for many years in Israel. I came back to the States in 1985 permanently. I had been back here a couple of times on sabbatical. I first took a job at University of California, Santa Cruz, and then I went to Rutgers University. And then I spent a period going back and forth half the year between Santa Cruz and Rutgers.
Oh, wow. And,
that ended in 2015, and I'm now still full-time at Rutgers. My job involves teaching half the year, and the rest of the year is wholly devoted to research.
That is awesome.
I don't know if you want any more background.
That's great.
Tom, would you tell us just one other thing? Why did you pick physics when you were getting your doctorate degree? What about science interest you?
Well, I was interested in science since I was a kid. My father was a professor of chemistry, and my mother was a biologist by training, and then she became a junior high school biology or science teacher. And so there was, you know, the whole house was full of science, and I just sort of picked the thing that appealed to me the most. I had certain teachers who were helpful in that, but it was mostly just what I thought was most interesting. I'm also not really very good with my hands, so experimental science was not for me. And so that's why I became a theorist, and I am pretty good at math. And so it was a natural to go into theoretical physics.
Thank you for that.
So I was Googling you this morning, trying to get some background, and I came across a little paper that was super interesting, where you were talking about the last quarter of 2016. And talking about how a macroscope, all right, I'm reading this from my copy paste here, but how the world underwent a macroscopic quantum tunneling event.
Okay, so there's a tradition in my field for April 1st, people joke papers. which, you know, some of them sound a little more serious than the one that I wrote, but the events of 2016 were so shocking.
Yes.
That I decided to combine them with all sorts of crazy ideas in physics that I didn't think were correct.
And okay.
Just make up this explanation for what happened.
Well, To a non-physics person, it was very convincing, because I was reading through it and I was like, yeah, that makes sense. And I was sharing it with my wife today, and she was like, yeah, I believe it too. I was like, okay, good. This explains everything.
I have a few questions, you know, not to fall in line with your research and your writings, because it is dense. You have an amazing body of work, and it's very impressive. And I'm very grateful that I get to know you. But I have the four more fundamental questions, which I have asked you a gazillion times. So what is life?
Well, I think, as I've told you before, I think the real answer to that is we don't know. I was just actually listening to a colloquium at Rutgers on Zoom by a well-known physicist who's tried to get into the field of what is life and so on. And he was, you know, explaining what his thoughts on this matter were. And there were a couple of people in the audience who were either biologists. One of them is a former physicist who actively works in questions of astrobiology and things like that, which, you know, what is life includes, are we going to find anything on other planets or any evidence for it? And they all sort of disagreed. I mean, people can't even agree about whether viruses are alive or not. So they have definitions of life according to which viruses are not alive. And it's when you make a definition, you try to make things very precise. But that's just a question of the words that you use to make the definition. So do we know if viruses are alive or not? Well, you know, we talk about the virus like it's a live thing, like it's out there trying to get us. And we just don't know. And there are more viruses by, I forget how many factors of 10. There are more virus species than there are species of anything else on the planet. And then after that, it's bacteria. And those are definitely considered to be alive by everybody. So the definitions of life tend to have to do with two things. One, whether the object reproduces itself in some way. And with viruses, the question is, well, they can't reproduce on their own or even with another partner of their own, quote, species. They have to invade a cell of another living organism in order to reproduce. So is that really life? Do we know? Not sure. Yeah. Then the other thing has to do with metabolizing things to make energy. That's the other thing that all life does. And life does that in different ways. So plants do that in a completely different way than we do. And before plants existed, the dominant forms of life on the planet were anaerobic. The kinds of bacteria that exist in cans of food and make you very sick. And those things died out because plants developed, and plants pour a lot of oxygen out into the atmosphere, and those things can't live in an oxygen atmosphere, and so they die. So all of those things were alive, but what precisely life is, we really have no idea, okay? And even more than that, there's this question of consciousness, okay? Are things conscious or not? So little one-celled bacteria do things that sort of seem conscious. You know, they stick out pieces of themselves to grab food and so on and so forth. But is that consciousness? Well, we tend to think not. But, you know, when it starts to get up to cats and dogs, you know, everybody who has a pet thinks their pet is conscious. But is that true? Is that true of birds? Is it true of worms? You know, there's some point. And my feeling about all of these things, there's a general concept in science in general, but also unfortunately in philosophy, this term is used with a completely different meaning. There's a word that, as far as I know, was invented by the physicist Philip Anderson called emergence, in which you start out with a system that has, you know, fundamentally physicists at least tend to believe that everything is made up of elementary particles, which make up atoms and molecules, and those, the chemistry of those is what's at the basis of life. And there's a phenomenon that happens all the time, and we have very concrete examples of this in physics, in some cases where we can derive these things mathematically, where you have a very complicated system made up of a lot of little tiny parts, and then there's kind of a collective behavior of the system. So one of the classic examples that people always talk about is if I think about water, all right? Water is actually made, we know this for sure, it's made of water molecules. And even if I have absolutely pure water, it's all made up of these tiny little things. But there's a science, a set of mathematical equations that describe the flow of water. They're called hydrodynamics, and there are some more detailed names that have to do with the people who discovered them. And those equations are true, and you really wouldn't want a better description of water than those equations, because any more precise description would be too complicated to ever have a chance of understanding. But you sort of say, oh, well, if I take this complicated description, I turn some cranks, I can prove these other equations that will exist for water, okay? And they'll describe water really well as you'd really like to describe it, as if it was a substance that just obeyed these laws. Okay, that's what's called an emergent law. It's something that doesn't, you know, in our more fundamental understanding, there is no such thing as, you know, the density of water and so on and so forth. There are things that have to do with, you know, how many water atoms there are at a certain place. But this continuous flowing density of water, or the height of a wave of water, that's not something that's in the fundamental equations, but it's, you would be crazy to try to use the fundamental equations to describe waves in the ocean. So my feeling about most of the words we use to describe life is that they're like that. They're emergent concepts that in this case, we don't really have any deep understanding of how they come out of more fundamental physical principles. And so it's a very open area, and one that it's not clear how much progress we're going to make in, say, the next 100 years in really having a deeper understanding of those connections. There are a lot of people working on these things, and it's interesting. It's a very hot and interesting field, but it's not clear when it's going to really have big payoffs.
Yeah. So let me ask you the second part of my question. So the question of life is still not clearly defined as through scientific methods. But the thing that I think we talked about this the last time we talked too, is the diversity of life or forms, right? So why is it that there are so many versions of things, right? So why are there so many different types of pine trees? Why are there so many different types of fish, cows, everything? Why is that necessary for, or is it necessary for the planet, the world? Why does this diversity exist, and what is the benefit of it?
Right. Well, okay, let me talk to the why first. The benefit is a loaded question. But let me talk to the why first. So our understanding, our best understanding of life, at least as far as I understand it, and I have to emphasize, I am not an expert in biology or genetics or any of those things. But my understanding of what those scientists know about life is that the fundamental thing that's going on is there's this molecule called DNA, which has the property that it can reproduce itself. It splits in half and makes each half makes a copy of the half that's missing, and they come together and they form new things. And sometimes when you do that, changes get made. in the structure of the DNA. And the DNA has a code embedded in it, which is it's the molecule is long, and there are these four base chemicals, the A, G, C, and T are their short names. And the order of those things is what determines a lot of properties of living organisms. And then everything starting from that, supposedly, though again, this is something that people do not really have a good understanding of or derivation of, supposedly everything else about life just started with that. And viruses are more primitive than that. They're sort of half a DNA molecule. That's why they can't reproduce on their own, okay? And so maybe they came first and then somehow two of them came together, but no clue whether that's true or not. The organisms, well, once you have this phenomenon happening, you can have something that reproduces itself. And then Darwin had this amazing insight in the 19th century that once that happens, in order to do this, the thing has to do various kinds of actions, and it needs energy to do those actions. And therefore, it has to accumulate energy from its environment in some way. And the organisms that succeed the best at doing that and then reproducing themselves tend to proliferate more. That was Darwin's big idea, okay? It's the theory of evolution. And the basic thing that leads to, and you can make computer games that model some of stuff, this sort of stuff, is that automatically leads to diversity. Because what you have is a very complicated system. So the DNA has a lot of these base pairs. They can be rearranged in many, many different ways. And you have to have the ability, this is called mutation, for some process to change them just by accident, randomly. And now if you have a system like that, it will tend to make lots of different things. So there's this game that was invented by a mathematician called the game of life, okay, where you start with a few basic rules on the computer and it generates all these shapes that move across the screen and stuff like that. And it generates certain shapes that kind of come back again and again and again. They're very stable and some of them just disappear. And then sometimes there are suddenly a new shape will appear. And that's way less complicated than real life. But the basic idea is that this self-reproduction property gives you diversity automatically. And then the diversity starts to create what we call ecological niches, because one of the ways that an organism can get the stuff that it needs to reproduce itself is by eating other things, okay? And that, for some of the chemicals that we need, the proteins, that's really the only way. You know, we have to eat at least plants in order to survive, and everything has to eat some other living organism, more or less, in order to survive. Plants, of course, themselves get energy from the sun without it eating anything, but they also need various other kinds of nutrients that they get, in particular from dead things in the soil that they're growing in. So everything is eating everything else, and that sets up this competitive cycle where some things are better at getting what they need to reproduce more than others, but there's nothing in that, it's all random, it's all statistical, and so there's nothing in that that says, oh, there's going to be one dominant form, okay? It'll just produce lots and lots of stuff, okay? And so we have a not complete, but a kind of vague understanding of the diversity of life and why there are all of these different things, because there are all kinds of ecological niches that things can live in and get their energy and reproduce themselves. And we see that working out. This theory works on a qualitative level very well. We see, you know, populations invading. Suddenly one population will decline because the other population is better than it. You know, when locusts come out and they start eating everything, everything else, you know, suffers. And so it really is a theory that on a qualitative level really does explain all of these things. And there's a lot of theorizing about it. A lot of the knowledge I've gotten from the popular books written by Stephen Jay Gould, who was a paleontologist really, but he wrote a lot about genetics and the theory of evolution. And they're really great books for getting a kind of qualitative knowledge of what's going on. So that I think is the basic answer to your diversity question and why there's so much diversity. There was the loaded question had a value judgment behind it. And in this view of things, there's no real notion of purpose behind all of this. It's just something, and we can make up mathematical models on the computer that don't give us the diversity of life, but they give us a kind of diversity that show you that this can happen as a consequence of random processes. And this basically the principle of natural selection. And it can be used in various ways. For example, I have a friend who's a professor of chemical engineering at Caltech who recently won the Nobel Prize. She invented, by thinking about the theory of evolution, she invented a way to have DNA search out useful chemicals. She sort of tried to program DNA to find different kinds of chemicals that would do specific tasks. And you know, her laboratory succeeded in doing this. And this is using the hardware of life to do something that's not really living, to do, you know, chemistry for making, I don't know, stuff for I'm not sure what, but let's say discovering oil or something like that. You do something that we think is useful in the world. So it's definitely a theory that accounts for a lot of what we see, and it accounts for it without any need for a reason or a purpose or anything like that. It's just, once you've got the key thing is you have to have DNA. You have to have something like it that can code a lot of information and reproduce itself. And we, as I said, I don't think we really understand how that happened.
Yeah.
Okay.
So one of the things I think I talked to you about before, and I talk about this a lot, is I use the universe as my example of diversity because of what you just said, right? So that when you look outside and you see a butterfly, and a few minutes later you might see a bright red butterfly and you might see a yellow butterfly, that some reason the universe allows itself to make copies and makes versions of things for some reason. And maybe it's in a scientific book someone hasn't discovered yet, but there must be some logic to why this much diversity exists in so many kinds of things. So one of my favorite things to study is the monarch butterfly. And it's an amazing creature to see it from its time when it's in the cocoon till it becomes a butterfly, and how those colors eventually proliferate all over that butterfly. And it's just like, not, there's nothing that says this should happen, you know, unless you're actually breeding the butterfly. In other words, someone's scientifically altering the butterfly to make it look like this. You know, they're breeding a one butterfly with a different kind of butterfly to come up with some super butterfly or colorful butterfly. But some of it is just, you know, mind numbing to think about it, but it must be a purpose for the university to have this much diversity, even in simple things.
I'm just not sure that that's correct. I really think that what we've seen is there's a lot of evidence that this can happen through random processes plus the principle of natural selection. The fact that this competition to reproduce more creates all kinds of strategies that are useful. And for example, one of the things that people talk about a lot and is now very well accepted in the theory of evolution is the eye is a very useful thing to have in the competition for finding resources and so on and so forth. Eyes have actually developed, if you look throughout all of life, they've developed independently in different species along different pathways. They're just not related to each other at all. Things, you know, the evolutionary tree looks like sort of a tree with branches going out. And there are species that separated from each other long before they had eyes. And they all developed eyes, and the eyes work in very similar ways. And they're not exactly the same, but they're very similar. And so this is a successful evolutionary strategy because of the physical conditions we live under, that there's sunlight coming down onto the earth, and that if you can capture some of that in a controlled way, it gives you a better feeling for what your environment is and allows you to capture prey or do whatever you need to get food. And so these things can happen in just a random way. I mean, that was really Darwin's genius. He went from the idea of breeding, which is purposeful, and he said, no, this can happen all on its own. And that was his big insight, that it can happen, you know, just random things with this force of competition for resources driving them. And plus the ability to reproduce and to have random changes. So you have to have mutations. And he didn't really understand that because he didn't understand the molecular basis of genetics. But that is now very well understood, to the extent that, as you well know, we can manipulate it now and make new species and new weird combinations of things and so on.
Thank you.
So I was curious, one thing I'm always curious when, so like you have this super deep understanding of the world and how things work together and energy and all that. Does that, as like a person, does that change you? Like knowing physics, like knowing how everything intertwines, like, you know, when you were talking about water, when I see water, I see water. That's it. Might make me thirsty. And then when you're talking about, you know, the atoms pulling it together and, you know, what makes waves, like, I know this is sort of a vague question, but does it change you? Does it make you a different person?
Yeah, I think the answer to that is probably not very much.
Yeah.
So when I look at water or drink it or swim in it and all of that stuff, I'm not thinking about this stuff.
Yeah.
Okay, I don't say, oh my God, you know, this is really made up of molecules. You know, I just, yeah, you know, it's water. I experience it like everybody else does. And that's true, I think, probably of most physicists. I mean, I've known some people, there are some physicists who are really good athletes or rock climbers and stuff like that. And some of those people have told me that they really use their physics knowledge in doing what they do. Yeah. In other words, they'll say, oh yeah, okay, you know, because of angular momentum, if I do this, I'm going to fall off a cliff and whatever. Okay. So there are people who have, you know, particular skills where understanding certain kinds of basic physics really does help, apparently. I have not had that experience in my life. Most of what I do is not affected by what I know about physics.
That's very good to hear. Like whenever I read about this stuff, I'm like, oh, if you can understand all this, like I would probably just have like profound sorrow on what everything is.
No.
And we are getting close to our half hour, but I also wanted to ask, what's your favorite movie that is based around your that has roots in your physics studies, if any?
Well, not really. So most of the movies that touch on the things that I know about in physics are movies where I have to sort of say, okay, I'm going to suspend belief. This is, you know, like things like traveling faster than light and all of that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
The best hard science fiction, probably without peer, that I've seen, certainly recently, but period, is this Expanse series that's on Amazon now. That is awesome, okay? Because that has some, you know, mysterious stuff in it that probably can't really occur, but it's got a lot of hard science thinking in it. And I also really like the political, sociological thoughts that are going into it about how life on Earth is going to develop and how a system where we could colonize the planets could lead to all sorts of inequalities and stuff. That really is by far the best science fiction I've seen in a long time.
That's awesome. That's awesome. I also love that show. It's the characters are great in it. The effects are really cool. So I'm glad to hear that that it makes sense, at least minimally from a physics perspective.
The books are even better. The part of the Expanse that doesn't make sense is all of the stuff. You know, after the protomolecule lets them go to different star systems through wormholes or whatever, that probably doesn't make sense. But
got it.
But the other stuff is very thoughtful. I mean, you know, interplanetary travel and what kinds of things people would be doing out there and stuff like that.
So Tom, I have one last question, Drew, if you'll allow.
Oh, yeah.
I read a scientific paper maybe about 3 or 4 months ago about the proliferation of man across the planet. Like, so, and the article starts off somewhere in Africa, and it says that in Africa, man started in Africa and walked across the continent. So they walked from Africa to China, to India, to England, wherever they walked. And, you know, for a minute there, I was like, is that really possible? You know, because there's a lot of study to talk about how little difference there is between man and chimpanzees in our DNA makeup and in the genetic coding of humans. But if that paper is correct, and it was someone's theory, they're working on their doctorate degree, if that is really correct, does that mean that there is genetic or DNA similarities between all humans? Going a little bit back to the biblical part of Adam and Eve and the evolution part of Darwin, is there a relationship between those two? Did we walk out of Africa? And I'm not asking you that question specifically, but if we did we walk out and become who we are today? And is there that much difference between person in America and person in Africa or in China or India, wherever they may be?
Yeah, so I think there are a couple of things that are involved here. I've certainly heard about this theory for such a long time that I would take it as something that is established, that, you know, the people who study early humans and so on know pretty well how this happened and roughly. I mean, there are all kinds of things we don't know. For example, there's this whole thing that has changed a lot in recent years, the question of what our relationship was with the Neanderthals. And whether we killed them off or what exactly happened there. Nowadays, if you go to 23andMe or one of those services, they will tell you that you have a percentage of Neanderthal genes. Not all of us, but for example, Anne has a certain percentage, according to them, of Neanderthal genes. So it seems, at least according to these companies, that we were actually able to breed with the Neanderthals.
I have some too, if that helps you. I did the ancestry and it says I have some too.
Yeah, no, I think that everybody's got different genes. As you said, we share, I think it's 98% of our genome with chimpanzees. That just shows you that very small changes in the genome can make really big differences.
Absolutely.
And the other thing that's really important is that for complex organisms, there's a lot that very clearly depends on development. It's not just your genetics that determine who you are. There's development in as an embryo, and afterwards, depending on, you know, how well you're fed and all sorts of stuff, various kinds of accidents that can happen. I know examples where, you know, babies who seemed perfectly normal in the beginning suddenly developed all sorts of abnormalities, which were not genetic. They were developmental abnormalities, and that can completely change what you turn out to be as a person. So the things that we consider important about humans are just not determined entirely by our genes. And there's this old idea of nurture versus nature. That's not a complex enough question to really capture things. There's this very complicated interaction between the genetic makeup and the developmental things, some things that happen accidentally, some things that happen because of conditions we can identify. You know, this child grew up in a country where there was a scarcity of food and was malnourished and will therefore behave differently than they would have behaved if they grew up someplace where they were fed better. And it's all of these things are extremely complicated at base, and they depend on all sorts of accidental stuff as well as stuff that we can find an explanation for. And so I think my understanding is that the theory that all humans are basically related to each other is a correct one. And that we're also, our other two nearest relatives are the chimps and the bonobos, the pygmy chimps. Yeah. And if it makes any difference, if you draw the tree of life, the bonobos come after us. They, you know, we're in between right. the regular chimps and the bonobos. That doesn't really mean very much. I mean, it's just, these are really more splittings off. Yeah. And saying when the splitting off of the branch occurred doesn't have anything to do with whether this species is more developed or more advanced than another one. Okay, it just split and it's different. Yeah. Okay. And so, it's all of these questions about life to me as a scientist look very, very complicated. And when my friends, I have colleagues who went from working in my field to working in biophysics. Mm-hmm. And some parts of biophysics that have to do with stuff like the mechanics of the heart and things like that, those are very well defined and you can make a lot of progress in them, but they don't answer fundamental questions like the questions you're asking. So the fundamental questions about life seem to me very, very remote from anything that we're going to be able to understand in the near term. Yeah. And I have very brilliant colleagues who disagree on that point. You know, it's just a complicated question, and some people have more confidence than others about how soon we'll be able to solve it.
Yeah.
Thank you for listening to Eminent Teachnology. If you like the show, please review, subscribe, and recommend us to your friends and family. We'd love to hear feedback from you as well. You can email us at eminentteachnology@gmail.com. See y'all soon.